Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. And I'm your host, Alan Warren. And joining me as a co-host today, we got Mr. Brian Turnoff.
Always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been a while. You've been laid up with your back, eh?
Yeah, just got a sprained back and just, you know, the first sign of getting old. So here I am, but recouped and ready to go, ready to talk tonight for sure with everybody. It's going to be a good one.
Yeah, did you have a back brace on? Wheelchair.
No back brace, just a little lidocaine patch and some painkillers, and a couple weeks later, you know, here I am. So.
all ready to go, yeah.
And a couple other, medication that I can't talk about on the air.
So. Yeah, that's right. You never know what state you'll be in and get arrested. Well, now today we are covering a true crime story, and we have a true crime author, and first time on the show. The book we are talking about will be The Case of the Murderous Dr. Cream, The Hunt for a Victorian-Era Serial Killer. And our guest is that author, Dean Jobe. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Well, Dean, before we cut into the story, let's kind of get a little bit about you. What got you into writing true crime?
I was a journalist for about two decades, a reporter and editor. My first assignment as a reporter was the court beat. So I was covering trials, but my undergraduate degree had been in history. So the two interests came together. I started researching true crime cases from the past here in Nova Scotia and then more broadly. And that's where I got the bug. So it's been about three decades. I've been off and on writing true crime, and I just find it such a vivid and engaging window into the past. The true crime cases, by their nature, there's drama, there's mystery, and also you have to understand the context. In this case, Victorian society. I've also written about the Jazz Age. They're really great entry points into vivid, engaging, and illuminating history.
You know, I see that as the Victorian era. So that in itself takes a lot of research as well. I mean, because you have to write the book in a way that people feel like it's got real you know, real parts to it, like the conversations, the way people dress, act, and what they did. It's quite a bit different than today.
Well, it just takes meticulous research. And I think as a writer, it's really important to get those facts absolutely correct for the reader. My second career, I guess, if you will, has been as an academic and teaching journalism and now teaching in a graduate program in creative nonfiction. And the word creative sometimes gives pause. Does that mean you create characters or you create dialogue? And the answer is no. It's the storytelling. So it's finding almost novelistic techniques, developing characters, setting scenes, having the action unfold, but absolutely grounded in the fact and true to the facts of what happened. So it's a really important part of what I do is I don't just tell you this is set in the Victorian age. I hope the readers are transported to the Victorian age and get a feel for it as I've tried to during my research.
Yeah, that's pretty, it's pretty interesting to get into a history like this, even if it is about murder or whatever the case be. How did you find out about this case? Like, what led you to this particular case?
Well, Dr. Cream is one of these. Well, first of all, he's almost the perfect villain for the Victorian era, running around in a top hat and a cape in the sinister fog of London at the end of his murderous rampage. He looks like he could be out of a casting agency if you wanted a Victorian villain. I discovered him. He's one of these shadowy figures as well in the literature. When you're looking at, when I'm researching old cases or in the Victorian times, I'd stumble over headlines about him, but also see accounts of his crimes in anthologies. And I guess, but what really made him stand out for me was this idea that how did this figure get away with as many as 10 murders in 3 countries? How was he able to kill time and time again? As I did my research, it became clear that most of the time he was the prime suspect, yet somehow managed, for the most part, to escape detection and punishment.
Do you think that their investigation was not as thorough, or do you think their skills were not as good? Is that sort of one of the reasons?
Part of it. He killed, his first murder was in 1877. He was ultimately put in prison for 10 years for one of his killings. This was one in a city of Belvedere in northern Illinois, only to be freed in 1891, go to London, kill four more women. So there were various policing agencies, various court officials, coroners, inquests, trials. So, but what really did link them together was trying for me as a researcher and a writer was to understand what was the state of detection, what were the forensic tests available. And of course, this is on the edge of the modern or the cusp of the modern era. Forensics are crude. Detection and skilled detectives are really just coming to the fore and are really only found in the larger cities. So Green benefited from some of these gaps. And then there were just at times miscues, miscommunications, missed opportunities, or he simply was able to evade suspicion long enough or arrest long enough to skip town.
You know, one of the parallels that I took away was that, and what benefited him and I mean, him being able to get away from the crime was that, you know, if you have money and you have class privilege, that's going to go a long way and be able to get away from your crimes. I mean, you talked how he was released from prison. I think that was because his family made some bribes. I mean, what are some of the other comparisons that you would draw to today?
Well, he was a doctor, and that meant that he was given a benefit of the doubt far too many times. He was professional. But most of his victims were patients or he was very closely tied to that made him a leading suspect. But it was hard for the authorities, for other doctors, in many cases, to make that leap that this fellow practitioner, this professional, as you said, this man of a high stature from a good family could be a killer. Cream used that to his advantage. But it also worked in another way. It brought his victims to him. Jack the Ripper pops up in my story because Cream killed on either side of Jack the Ripper's rampage in Whitechapel in 1888 in London. So his name pops up. And Jack the Ripper, as you'll know, stalked his victims. It was a brutal killer who sought out his victims. Cream was a different kind of killer. Cream's victims came to him. Many of them were young women desperate for an illegal abortion. This was a service that Cream was only too happy to provide, and in some cases, kill the women who'd come to him and trusted him to help them in this time of need, because they weren't married. They felt they had to terminate their pregnancies.
What kind of doctor was he?
One of his specialties was midwifery, and that meant that he had a lot of female patients. At one point, he was making it known that he specialized in diseases of the womb. And this could have been just a clever way of, or a euphemism for an illegal abortionist. He certainly was highly trained. He was a graduate of McGill Medical School in Montreal, class of 1876. It was the most prestigious medical school in Canada at the time. He did graduate or postgraduate work at St. Thomas's Hospital in London, and was actually licensed by the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Edinburgh, which was one of the top qualifications in the world at the time. So he had no shortage of skills, but it's the way he used those skills. One of his profs at one of his professors in medical school urged the students to be godlike in their practice, to come between the living and the dead. I think it's a useful way to think of Cream, because he decided he would have a godlike status and play God and ultimately decide which of his patients would live that he'd help and which would die. His method of killing was to lace medicine that he prescribed or provided with deadly strychnine.
Wow. Did he have a particular person or type of person he wanted to kill, or was it just random?
Well, at random, except that there are people who came to him. It did change when he was released from prison, as was noted, in 1891 and headed to London. He preyed on sex workers at that time and killed four women in the Lambeth neighborhood, became known as the Lambeth Poisoner. The one commonality is they were women. And they were either women who came to him in desperation for legal abortions early in his career, or he was a customer of sex workers in Lambeth, and some of them he chose to die.
Yeah, I want to touch on his psychopathy for a second, because on one side you can see that he's kind of like a wolf in sheep clothing, wealthy, religious, educated. You take him on that, all that on face value at that time, particularly, you're not going to think he's a serial killer or a killer at all. But I think I'm on the other side of that, where in my opinion, that because of the way that he killed, as poison was his main way, I think that's cowardly. And that says a lot about who he is. I mean, in your opinion, though, what does his MO, how he killed the people that he killed, reveal about his psychology?
Oh, well, cowardly is a good way to put it. He doesn't stick around to see what he's done, but his medical training means he knows he's consigning his victims to a horrible death. Strychnine causes a series of horrible seizures. It mimics tetanus, which was common at the time. Although it was pretty easy for a skilled medical practitioner to tell the difference. But victims would suffer these agonizing seizures followed by breaks that they would be lucid, but they would know they were dying. Cream knew this was what was going to happen. He knew the effects of strychnine because he learned about poisons like this as part of his medical training. Strychnine in trace amounts was used in commonly used in medicine at the time. He just chose to load medicine with a deadly dose of this. So you're right about cowardly, but I think it plays into this idea of godlike. I mean, what could be more sinister than a murderer who could kill from a distance, who could be long gone from the scene by the time the patient, acting on his instructions, took the medicine, took the poison medicine he prescribed. It was really part of his pathology, I guess, or his approach to do this. And, unlike Jack the Ripper, who was up close and personal, Thomas Neal Crean, got some kind of sadistic enjoyment out of just imagining the death throes of his victims.
So you think that was kind of part of it? Like he did want them to suffer?
Oh, yes. Because he wouldn't have chosen such a deadly poison. And it wasn't because there was very rudimentary toxicology and forensics at the time. But strychnine was known, could be detected. There were some early tests to detect it. So it wasn't he was picking this poison because it would evade suspicion or evade him being caught. The method he employed, putting it in medicine that would be taken when he was long gone, was the way he evaded being caught and would be free to kill again.
A lot of times you really get like a window into their mind, serial killers and killers and, you know, psychopaths. They talk a lot. I mean, what did Crean say about Crean?
Well, Crean didn't talk a lot. What he did was he wrote a lot. You'll know from the story that ultimately when he's in London, he writes letters, blackmail letters to the physicians of the royal family, a sitting member of parliament, a prominent doctor, and accusing them of his murders using pseudonyms. Some of these letters are written in his own handwriting, and that helps catch him. Because these letters can be traced back to his hand through his handwriting. But as I did my research, I realized and discovered that this had been part and parcel of his modus operandi all along. Early on, he would write letters accusing others, either so he could evade capture or suspicion. That sort of morphed into plots to kill someone and then blackmail or threaten to expose or accuse a pharmacist of making a mistake in the medicine, to actual outright blackmail in London. The odd thing is, there's no evidence at any point Crean ever made a dollar from any of these threats. Hmm. What they became was evidence against him. But I think they also, you were saying about windows into mind, I think they also suggest a need to gloat or a need to show off. Certainly a need to needlessly expose himself to possible detection. Because in one case, I mean, the death of one of his patients had been attributed to natural causes. He demanded the body be exhumed and tested for strychnine because he hoped to blackmail the provider of the medicine. That rebounded against him. He ended up on trial for the murder.
Wow. You know, during this whole time, did he have a family? Was he married? What was going on in his personal life?
His personal life, well, first of all, we mentioned about his upbringing from a wealthy family, as was noted by Brian, church-going, plenty of money to send him to a prestigious medical school. He flaunted his wealth, his fine clothes and his jewelry, alienated many of his classmates as a result. So you're starting to see a kind of a selfish streak that may support this kind of narcissistic behavior and a man really with very little conscience. He married in 1876, soon after graduating medical school. He married a young woman named Flora Brooks from a small town in Quebec. He married her because he was forced to. They were engaged. She got pregnant. He performed an abortion that almost killed her. The result was he was forced to marry her and forced into this marriage. And it becomes pretty clear from the evidence that within months he was sending her medicine. He'd gone to London for further training, left her in Canada. She took this medicine and admitted as much to her family doctor, but it ultimately killed her. So I think it's pretty clear that was his first victim. That was the only time he ever married. But he did have brothers and sisters back in Quebec City who, of course, became increasingly concerned about his behavior. A few of them visited, or one, his brother did visit him when he was in prison. But when he came back to Quebec City after his release in 1891, his family was very happy to send him to London to get him out from underfoot, because he was very erratic and very unstable. And they felt as if some sort of change of scenery would help him. But of course, they were sending him to London. They helped send him to London, where he ultimately killed more people.
You know, over the past few decades, as we've studied killers and psychopaths, commonalities and patterns have developed. One in particular is that there will be some type of childhood experience or experiences that somewhat you can that indicate of who they will become. Was there anything like that in his childhood that would tell you he might become a serial killer?
No, I mean, a few things that stand out. His mother died when he was 19. He was still at home at this point. He went to medical school when he was in his 20s. And by all accounts, he was profoundly affected. It was a long, lingering death. He was very attentive at her side. But, you know, that at the time in the Victorian era, you know, the death rate of younger people was higher. So that on its own, I don't think is definitive. The narcissistic streak, maybe another layer here. Being trapped as a young man into a marriage that he then engineered a way to get out of with using poison, perhaps that started fueling what became a very clearly a burning hatred of women. That manifests itself when he started, because nine of the 10 victims I was able to identify are women. And, so maybe some clues there.
It's pretty interesting case. Now, without giving away too much, did he ever get caught?
Well, he ultimately does. And, I guess there's, a spoiler alert in the title, he's the murderous Dr. Crean. I couldn't conceive of any way to write this other than to make it a how done it, not a who done it. And what I wanted to do, I start the book with his release in 1891 from Joliet Prison after serving 10 years of a life sentence. And as Brian noted, very, very compelling evidence that his family put up enough money to buy his early release, a bribe or some kind of kickback. Start there. And then, because my central question is in the subtitle, The Hunt For, I wanted to understand how he got away with it for so long and so many times, as I mentioned. So that sets him up for his final four murders in London, his eventual arrest in 1892, and then he goes on trial. But Scotland Yard at that point starts discovering this dark past, because he's killed as many as six people in Canada and the United States, three women in the Chicago area alone, where he practiced for about 2 years. So they send Inspector Frederick Jarvis to Canada and the United States to interview witnesses, check court records, verify where he's been, develop as much as they can a profile of the many murders of Thomas Neal Crean. And I thought that was an effective way to tell the story. So you go back in time as I reconstruct Crean's past, but the thread through it are the various discoveries of Inspector Jarvis. So I hope readers will be looking over my shoulder as they read, as they look over the shoulder of Inspector Jarvis and just learn about the missed opportunities, mistakes, outright, in some cases, corruption of the justice system that allowed Crean to kill as many as 10 times.
Yeah, I see that in the foreword, how you talk about the bungled investigations and the corrupt officials. Was that in all three countries?
It varied. Every murder was distinct. In most were strychnine. One was poisoning with chloroform.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Form. One was a botched operation. But the actual circumstances varied. For instance, in London, Ontario, a female patient who he admitted had come to him for an abortion was found dead, chloroform poisoning. And it looked like it had been set up to look like a suicide. Crean was very quickly the prime suspect. But he managed to throw up enough confusion and his first letter accusing someone else of the crime that the coroner simply, and the coroner's jury simply came with an open verdict by persons unknown. Everybody in this city felt he was guilty, but he was never charged. So no outright corruption there, missed opportunity, maybe a lack of evidence, maybe a lack of vigilance. The police force in the city of London, Ontario, was very small at the time and undermanned. He gets to Chicago. There is evidence of outright corruption. In fact, he stands trial in 1880 for murdering a woman in a botched operation. There's compelling evidence against him. But his father has the money to hire the best lawyer in town, Alfred Trude, who also had a reputation for bribing juries. There's no direct evidence he bribed this jury, but despite the strong evidence, he won an acquittal for Crean. So, and then of course, in terms of official corruption, the money that clearly changed hands to get him out of prison, and set him up to kill four more times, you know, is another example of just, the flaws and corruption of this, of the justice system in Illinois at the time.
Yeah. Leave it to the Americans. we have to be corrupt, you know? Well, it's pretty fascinating. Now, do you have a subtext or an idea underneath the main theme or story of the book? Is there something you want people to take away from this book?
Well, I think of how much or on what level Cream is a product of the repression and misogyny and double standards of the Victorian era. I'd say at one point he's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde come to life, respectable doctor by day, debauched, drunken, reprobate at night in some of the communities he's in. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde was all about this sort of inner evil, and Cream seems to embody that. The idea that women were driven to him, that they couldn't dare have a child out of wedlock. They were desperate for abortions. One observer described the idea of a woman who was unmarried having a child as a living death. So the stigmatization of women, and when he gets to London, the stigmatization of sex workers who are not seen as very important. And you can see in some of the policing records even that the frustration of the police trying to deal with calling the women of Lambeth unreliable because they don't seem very helpful with the investigation, but of course overlooking the fact that these are women who have no interest in dealing with the police and are actually trying their hardest to stay out of the sight of the police. But you do see a lot of some sexism in the way at various stages the courts or the police handle the cases.
There are a lot of shades of Jack the Ripper and H.H. Holmes when you talk about Thomas Cream. So I kind of want to talk about those for just to stick with that for a little bit. One particular, I want to trail back to something that you said earlier in the conversation, and you brought up Jack the Ripper, and through your research in your book, I mean, you pretty much proved that Thomas Cream, sometimes he's associated with being Jack the Ripper, that there's pretty much no way that he could have been. But I also want to touch on one other part of that is that, you know, people think that because supposedly his last words as he was being hung was that he was confessing to be Jack the Ripper. But then another Cream biographer, and I'm sure you've heard about this, is that what he was actually was when what was happening is that when he was losing control of his bodily functions as he was being hung, he was saying, "I'm ejaculating." I mean, that's a pretty big discrepancy between being Jack the Ripper and "I'm ejaculating." I mean, what are your thoughts on that part of his, you know, at the end of his life and Jack the Ripper association?
Well, I did see that in the research. And first of all, there's so many rat holes you're going down to even get there. It's important to know that Cream has an ironclad alibi. He was in Joliet prison in the fall of 1888. He bought his way out in 1891. That's led to speculation. Maybe he bought his way out earlier. Well, that doesn't hold up because why would his family spend all that money in 1891 to get him out of prison if he was already out of prison? But beyond that, let's unpack this idea that his last words in the scaffold were, "I am Jack the trap sprung, for all time." We're left with the idea that he was about to, confess to being Jack the Ripper and possibly something else. There's no mention at all at the time of his execution in 1892, any of this. I was able, through my research, through newspaper databases, which are quite complete for this era, to show that about a decade later, in 1902, small newspaper items showed up claiming that the hangman, Billington, had heard these last words. Well, Billington was dead by then, so there was no way to verify it. It got picked up, scattered references, United States and in Britain. And then that story died, only to be resurrected decades later in features, believe it or not, there was such a thing as features about last words on the scaffold. Well, this is a hard one to resist. And somehow that story was included. But by now it's taken on the veneer of fact or of truth. And that's really the basis for this idea that he could have been Jack the Ripper. And nothing more. As I said, at the time, the press, the police even referred to the Whitechapel murders, Jack the Ripper. There was speculation that here was another example of the new kind of monster that Jack the Ripper was, the serial killer in our midst. But never a suggestion it could be Cream. So I'll go with the weight of evidence from the time. And I think today we have a term, fake news, that would apply to this rather a fanciful notion that he made this a confession. So my position would be, based on the evidence I've seen, it was never made. It's a good story that's been hard to put down. And I do find that in recent years, Cream was, for decades, based on this thin reed of imagination, was touted as a potential Ripper suspect. There'd be a story on the Ripper crimes and then the inevitable sidebar of leading suspects and he'd be there. That has stopped in recent years, I think, because it's clear he couldn't have done it. But I did a Jack the Ripper tour as part when I was doing my research in London. Sure enough, at the very end, he's trotted out as a potential Ripper suspect. So it's a hard myth to eradicate, and I don't know if my book will do that, but I think we can be confident that those words were never said, and it's clear that as I said, he has an alibi. And another Ripperologists, people who study the Ripper murders, have also noted that same city, London, same victims, sex workers, but totally different methods. Jack the Ripper slashed with knives. Cream killed from afar with strychnine. So really, basically one conclusion was, well, different man, different method, you know, not the Ripper.
Yeah, after reading the book, I don't know what's more absurd, that him saying, you know, as he's behind, I am Jack the Ripper, or I am ejaculating. I mean, either way, it's fairly ridiculous. But like I mentioned before, that not only are there shades of Jack the Ripper, but there are also shades of H.H. Holmes, which you mentioned a lot of the commonalities that they do, that they have. I mean, why doesn't someone like Dr., you know, Thomas Cream, who, why doesn't someone like him get that same recognition, you know, horrible recognition as Jack the Ripper or H.H. Holmes?
Well, I mean, first of all, recognition. I mean, one of the things I set out to do was to put names and life to his victims. One thing that I found from earlier accounts, I mean, many of his victims, the names were wrong or spelled wrong. The cities where they lived were wrong. I tried to make them people, and my focus on the detection and the shortcomings, how he got away with it. I think it's important to deflect some of the attention from the killer at all times. But really, it is an important question. Why has Cream been seemingly forgotten? And I think in the Ripper's case, or compared to the Ripper, it's simply that this endless fascination, almost obsession of so many people with trying to figure out who was it. I mean, to the point of even bringing in Cream, the most unlikely of suspects. And I think that's given his case an afterlife and an enduring mystery. The fact that it was unresolved, that has meant that even in our own day, he's ubiquitous. Everyone's heard the name. Everyone has some idea about the crimes. H.H. Holmes, again, was he started his crimes at the World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago in 1893, so he actually postdates Cream. But Holmes perhaps more known and reviled, partly because of his he wrote a book and or a book was based on his confessions. He confessed to 27 murders, only to be discovered that some of the people he thought he murdered were still alive. He had at least there was the image that he was an even more prolific serial killer. But Eric Larson's book, of course, has meant that H.H. Holmes is will live in infamy in a way that a similar way, I guess, that Jack the Ripper has.
Well, now they're saying Holmes was Jack the Ripper.
Well, I guess the job is still open for somebody.
Well, you know, it's crazy. Everyone seems to be Jack the Ripper, but it's a really interesting book. And I see that you've you also write an article as well for a the Ellery Queen.
Yeah, I'm their true crime columnist. So every other month I do a short true crime story, France, England, America, Canada. I just interesting cases. Often the column is called Stranger Than Fiction, being fact. But also I do try to find strange cases, and I alternate that with roundups of recent true crime titles that interest me, or so mini reviews of sort of the latest in the genre.
Wow, that's fascinating. I haven't looked at it yet, but I will. And you're part of the Crime Writers of Canada.
That's right, and the Mystery Writers of America, and actually the Crime Writers Association in Great Britain.
Wow, you get around.
Well, I don't travel there, but I belong.
I'm in the Crime Writers of Canada as well. I've been there a couple of years. So.
Well, they're just great organizations for comparing notes and meeting people and supporting other writers.
Yeah. Where to next for you after this book is settled? What's your plans next?
Well, I historical nonfiction is my obsession, I guess. My previous book, Empire of Deception, was about a Chicago swindler who out-Ponzied the famous Charles Ponzi. He was running a Ponzi scheme in Chicago for two decades before it had a name, and was running a claim to have oil wells in Panama and conned a whole lot of wealthy people in Chicago before he was caught. So I've done a con man, now done a serial killer. I'm now spending some time research-wise with a gentleman jewel thief from the 20s, again, from the same era as Empire of Deception, the Roaring 20s. And it's really developing into a fascinating look at wealth, excess, and class in the Roaring 20s. It's a fellow who could crash parties in a tuxedo while he cased a joint so he could come back and steal jewels later. So the Netflix series on Lupin has really caught the imagination of people. I thought it was so well done. And there's sort of a rich cultural vein of this idea of the gentleman thief. Who is he good, is he bad? But in the end, you can't help rooting for him a bit, especially when he's stealing insured jewels from people who have too much money.
What do you think your biggest challenge is when you cover an older crime case like this? For me, I would imagine getting into the head of the killer, because it's going to be really hard if you don't have a diary or anything from that person themselves.
Well, that's when you sometimes have to get not creative in terms of the material, but creative in what you look for. My con man, Ponzi schemer for Empire of Deception, didn't leave much of a trail for me, but he did give a very detailed confession and was on a witness stand for hours explaining his con. So that gave me a really good base of firsthand material. Yeah, you want to get from the mouth of your, from the mind of your central character. There was less of that with Cream, but I made the most of everything I could find, because every once in a while he did testify or spoke up, or I would find a transcript, or he gave interviews as he was going through various court processes. In this particular case of the gentleman thief, the first thing I look for is there enough there to bring the character to life for the reader? And in this case, I've got a gentleman jewel thief who not only has all of his exploits that he talks about in later life, but actually came to regret having wasted his life, because he ultimately spends quite a bit of time in prison. And so there's almost a redemption, or there is sort of a redemption angle on that. So again, it's the first thing. I think it's almost the deal breaker when you look at trying to do historical true crime. Will there be enough material to make the main person whole? And of course, then you want to, any diary or memoir by police investigators or victims or anyone else involved that will help support that. So as much as possible, you're telling the story in real time through the memories and recollections and statements of the people involved.
Now, do you have a website of your own, or a place that you like people to come and find out about your writing and books?
Absolutely. www.deanjobb.com. All my books are there. Of course, my publisher for Empire, this book, and my next book, Algonquin Books in New York, they have a big web presence as well. And there's been really good response to the Dr. Cream book, and I keep it up to date. So I invite folks to take a look.
So, hey, you know, during the pandemic, the worst part of it in the last couple of years, all the craziness, how was it for you to write?
Fortunately, I had all of my research for Cream done, for the Dr. Cream book done, because I believe you have to go to the locations. So I was in London twice. I was in Chicago for 2 weeks. I followed Cream's, as a young man from Quebec City to Montreal to the small community in Quebec where he met and ultimately murdered his wife. That's a problem. For me, I was mostly writing during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But as I start on my new project, I will have some travel, and I am hopeful that as things open up, I'll be able to do that. And it's partly because the records are there. Amazingly, even a century ago, a file from a century ago will probably be in the original courthouse where the trial was heard. Yeah. So I want to see the locations, but I also want to go there. And you can hire researchers, and sometimes there's advantages to that if it's not a big part of the story. But as much as possible, I like to handle the documents. I like to see it all. And you pick up so many little clues and informations and sense of a place, even what it was like a century ago, that you can then convey in your writing.
So that actually it kind of influences your feeling when you write the book.
I think so, yeah. I mean, I've got to make these places real to the reader. It helps if they're real to me. Things will have changed, buildings will have disappeared. But I think it's really important to see what's left of that world as much as possible. And, you know, there will be change, but I can compare to vintage photographs and make sure I'm not describing things that weren't there. But I do think if the writer has that sense of place, that roots in the story, roots on the ground, I guess, for want of a better word, I hope that comes through in the writing for the reader.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting how that does. But did the pandemic itself, I know a lot of writers, some of them felt stressed, and so they were unable to write, while others, the stress made them, you know, even more excited about writing. Does that sort of, when weird things are going on and it's stressful around your life, does that sort of get in the way of writing?
I can see how it could, depending on your circumstances. I tend to be an early riser, and I write a lot in the mornings. And we've here in Nova Scotia, we've gone through some lockdowns, not quite as many, I think, as other areas of North America. But that said, we stayed close to home, and actually that it was sort of the best of hobbies and pastimes for me to have that to concentrate on. So I think it was it really helped with the pandemic. But if I had been trying to research cream in the middle of this with the massive Scotland Yard file on his case on the other side of the Atlantic and unable to go, it would have been a problem. So I was just lucky in my timing.
And you had that mass shooting there, didn't you? The guy that impersonated a cop?
That's right, yes. 22 people killed, the worst mass shooting in Canadian history. Just about an hour and a half's drive from where I live.
That's crazy, stuff like that. A lot of pressure, I guess. The world's just, people just go crazy, you know?
And it does seem like the pandemic played some role in that, but that case is subject of an inquiry that we seem to be still quite a long ways away from having a lot of the evidence produced to explain what happened there.
Yeah. Strange things in the world. Boy, I'll tell you. Well, it's certainly been great talking to you, and it's been a pleasure having you here. Now, the book we're talking about is The Case of the Murderous Dr. Cream, and this is The Hunt for Victorian Era Serial Killer, and our guest is the writer of that book, Dean Jobe. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Alan.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.